You are what you eat. It's an expression every grade school student has heard, either as a boast or as a taunt. But today's guest says that what we eat, what we cook, and the meals we share can tell us a lot about race, access, privilege, heritage, and culture. She's Korsha Wilson this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wade Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. So each week we welcome talented storytellers and scholars to help us make sense of the big narratives shaping public life today. This week we're joined by Korsha Wilson, a cook, an author, and host of the podcast, A Hungry Society. Korsha, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm fascinated by the work you do, and we want to talk about it at some length, but I asked you something back in the green room. How did you find this line of work? How did you come to do what you do?
Yeah, so I am a really weird food writer in that I decided that I wanted to be a food writer at 10 years old.
At 10 years old? At 10. Wow.
A lot of food writers just kind of fall into it. But I remember the specific moment when I decided I wanted to be a food writer. I had gone to Borders Bookstore. I don't know if you remember those stores.
Yeah,
back in the day.
Yeah. I do remember.
And I was walking through the magazine section, and I came across a Savour magazine. And it was like, it had food on the cover, and I was just like, what is this? And I like sat down in the aisle and like read it cover to cover. And
at the age of 10?
At the age of 10.
Okay.
And I took it to my mom and I said, this is what I want to do. And she was like, okay, let's figure it out. So
really?
That's, yeah.
So
that's
when
a
you
true
say,
calling.
When you are a food writer, that's different from being a food critic.
Yes. So there are like aspects of criticism to the things that I write, but I mostly focus on people and culture when I talk about food, because I think that food is a great method to do that.
So your education really incorporated both writing and also your love of food. So tell us a little bit about that. You went to the Culinary Institute of America, is that correct?
Yes, I did my associate's degree in culinary arts at CIA in Poughkeepsie, New York, and that was an incredible experience.
How long is that?
2 years.
2 years, wow. Mm-hmm. Did you ever get out to Napa, because they have another branch out in Napa?
No, I've actually never been to the Greystone campus.
Okay, that's a majestic place.
But it was like completely different than any college experience. You wake up at like 6 a.m, put on your chef whites and, you know, a big tall chef's toque, and you go and you cook for 6 to 8 hours a day with a chef and a class of about 20 students, and you move through different courses, and your coursework is like write this recipe and, you know, study this chef. It's very different than any normal college experience.
So that's learning about cooking and food. How mm-hmm. did the writing part, going back to age 10, come into the mix here?
So while I was at culinary school, I did write for the paper there. Okay. There is a very small school paper at the Culinary Institute of America. And then after that, I moved to Boston to go to journalism school at Emerson. And I did print and media journalism for a few years before I started working in restaurants and really fell into that and felt like that was a passion as well.
So working in restaurants as a cook?
A cook at first, and then as I got further into my studies, I couldn't do a full week of work in the kitchen.
Working in restaurants is hard, it's laborious.
Tough.
It's serious work.
Yes, it's very tough.
And requires intense concentration too to get mm-hmm. all that right under such pressure.
Yes. So I started working in front of the house because I could do one or two shifts a week and still focus on writing. And that completely changed my life. Like, I loved working in the front of the house in restaurants.
So when did you start writing professionally?
I started writing for free while I was working in restaurants. I would just send out my pieces to alternative weekly papers in Boston, the Weekly Dig, just hoping someone would publish it. And I eventually got enough clips and enough bylines that I sold my first paid piece to Boston Magazine.
Well, congratulations. That must have felt good.
It felt so great. And I wrote about a server in Boston who works at a restaurant in Chinatown who was just like everyone's favorite server. And I wanted to highlight her and her story and the restaurant that she works in. And it felt so good to get paid for that.
So you're doing food writing, but at some point in your career, you began to look at, for lack of a better term, the larger context. And I want to read something from one of the pieces you wrote, because I think it sort of summarizes your philosophy and what you do now. Quote, every time we step to our stoves to make a meal, we're engaging with the society around us. Each ingredient that we use, every technique, every spice tells a story about our access, our privilege, our heritage, and our culture. The foods and dishes we consume are all part of larger forces that impact our lives. Our appetites and what we crave are the result of our place in the world at that time. Talk about that. That's a fairly profound statement.
So that is part of an essay that I wrote about these three cookbooks that came out within the past year. The Immigrant Cookbook, the Sous Chef's Indigenous Cookbook, and Feed the Resistance. And when I thought about those three books and what they had in common, it was really about cooking and eating, the ability that it has to speak about where we are in the world at any point in time, and to fuel us as we help our communities, as we are a part of our communities. So I think we often think about cooking as like a means to an end, like, I'm hungry, so I'm going to cook something and eat it. But the ingredients that you use, the way that you cook, how you learned how to cook, where you shop, like that is all part of the community around you. It's part of a larger cultural force. And the way we cook today is different than 50 years ago. That was different than 50 years before then. It's always about where we are in time and where we are in the country and in the world.
Is it going too far to describe cooking as a form of storytelling?
No, it absolutely is. Absolutely.
Could you just draw that out a little bit?
Yeah. So we were talking off camera about Peru.
Yeah.
I recently went, and the chefs there, you see the chefs telling the story of the Peruvian mountains or the Amazon or the northern fishing villages through their restaurants and through their food. And that's what any chef does, really. Like, even at home, that's what you're doing, is just telling a story of where you are in life. But I think a plate of food is way more than just a plate of food. It is a story.
So it's often said that music is the universal language, but in a sense, food is another sort of universal language, mm-hmm. is it not? Talk about sort of the experience of sitting down with someone and sharing a meal, particularly someone who might be from a different culture, from a different background, a different race, and what that can do to bringing two people together and to have a conversation.
Mm-hmm. I think in the same ways that music is kind of universal and understood, so is food. Like when you sit down, like whenever I travel, that is the most important thing for me. Where am I going to eat? Where do the locals like to go here? Like, what is the like essential restaurant of this place? Because it's a way of understanding a place where you are, but it's also a way to connect to people that you may not know. I think food is one of the best ways to do that.
It's a social experience.
Yes.
Yeah. You introduced some concepts in looking through the prep materials for this episode that I was a little unfamiliar with, and so maybe you can unpack them a little bit for us. What is food sovereignty?
So food sovereignty is the access and privilege that you have to cook what you want, to eat what you want. And that is, in different parts of the country, it looks different. I think a lot of times we hear the term like food desert.
Yeah, which I
don't think is completely accurate, because a desert implies that there's nothing, that there's an absence of food. There, in certain areas, like in urban areas, there's food there. It's just what kind of food is available.
We hear that term, though, a lot of times sort of in communities that are economically depressed, with high crime rates and big sort of the mega chain supermarkets have left those markets entirely. Mm-hmm. And so there's not, you know, you can't go into the sort of the big, you know, 20 aisle grocery store to get whatever you want.
Right.
But there tend to be, I think, in those cases, smaller markets that serve, mm-hmm. that continue to serve those communities, but not the same experience that a lot of other Americans might be familiar with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So what about the term food justice? We've come across that also. What does that mean, and how would that be different from food sovereignty?
So food justice encompasses what we were just speaking about, like about access to different markets and, you know, different levels of food service, from fast food to fine dining. But it also encompasses land justice. So, you know, small and medium farmers, you know, farmers of color, women farmers, having access to land, reestablishing connections to the land for Black and brown people and indigenous people in this country, because there's a long history of land being taken from those groups.
Yeah,
there's
no kidding.
Many like great organizations doing work in that space, like the National Black Food and Justice Alliance, I've written about, and they focus like exclusively on those issues, specifically about land justice. And how do we encourage more Black and brown farmers in this country?
And what about Native communities? You mentioned earlier one of the cookbooks that you had reviewed, the Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. Is mm-hmm. there a movement in Native communities to reestablish or to more firmly establish?
And it's just for folks who may be listening on radio, it's Sioux, S-I-O-U-X, not Sioux, S-O-U-S. A little play
yes.
on words there.
Yes. Yeah. So Chef Sean Sherman wrote that book, and it has, I'm actually working on a piece about just that book right now. It completely shifted the way I looked at cookbooks. It starts with him talking about why he doesn't make a recipe called Indian fry bread, which when people think of Native foodways, that's one of the first things they think of. And it's very simple, like flour and lard and sugar deep fried. And he starts the book by saying, you will not find that recipe in this book, because that recipe comes out of, you know, Native people being taken off of their lands and having to subsist off of what the government gave them, white flour, lard, and sugar.
So it has genocidal roots, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So he focuses on, you know, rediscovering and preserving Native American foodways, meaning, you know, pickling, smoking, Native berries, wild game meats, like making sure that those foodways stay alive so they can be passed on to other generations. And he is in Minnesota.
He's in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where his tribe is, or his nation?
Yes.
Okay, he's in Minnesota.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkably talented team at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. By day, I'm the executive director of the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. Joining me, as always, is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller, who in his day job is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. You can connect with Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is Korsha Wilson, a remarkably talented writer and podcaster who hosts A Hungry Society, a podcast about food, food media, class, race, and more. You can find her at 2 different Twitter accounts, at Korsha Wilson, K-O-R-S-H-A Wilson, or at A Hungry Society. You wrote a piece for Yes Magazine titled Cooking Stirs the Pot for Social Change. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that piece.
Yes, yeah, so we spoke a little bit about it before with the 3 cookbooks I was writing about. Yeah. And I start the piece by talking about making this big, like 15-pound tray of macaroni and cheese for a potluck. And at, I was walking through Brooklyn to like this venue where the potluck was. And on the way there, I was just like, my arms are hurting. And I was just like, why didn't I just buy like some tortilla chips and some salsa and just like call it a day? But I was thinking, you know, no, like I said in the group chat, like I'm bringing macaroni and cheese. And everyone was like, oh my goodness, I'm so excited. And as we were all eating it, it was just like, it wasn't just about me and like feeling tired, you know, like babying this dish. It was about, you know, like nourishing my community, the people that in turn like nourish me. And I was just thinking about how, you know, that led me to how cooking is not just about the act of cooking. It's about so much more than that.
And that was in Yes Media Magazine. And I want to give a shout out to Yes, because that's an outstanding publication. Let me just read how they describe themselves, and then we'll move on to more of your work. A nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism that inspires people to build a more just, sustainable, and compassionate world. Highly recommended. So another one of your pieces was in Munchies. And we should mention here that you've had pieces in the New York Times and many, many other places now that your freelance career is a full-time career. And this story was called The Double Blind of Being a Woman of Color in the Food World. Women of color are often unheard in this industry. When we're not, we're outright dismissed by gatekeepers if they don't like what we have to say. That would seem to be particularly pertinent to 2018.
Yes. That story, I don't know if it's so much a story as like a personal essay. An incredible woman named Nadine Nelson, who does work in the food justice space, and she's actually based in Connecticut. She was speaking at an event, and there was a very well-known food writer speaking, and she asked him if he feels responsible to communities of color. And he ignored her and didn't respond, moved on to someone else. And I remember watching the clip and feeling like enraged, but it was familiar. I understood why he did it. It was just like, I don't need to, you know, interact with that or engage with that. I can just move on.
It was familiar to you? Like,
yes.
This is an experience that was...
Yes, as a woman of color, like, I'm familiar with being... Are my questions or my concerns being kind of brushed off or ignored completely. And so, and
that. Even now.
Even now, yes.
Wow.
So, with that piece, I spoke about, you know, working in restaurants and not really being listened to or respected. And I think that's one of the hard things about being a woman of color in the food world is, you know, it's like, don't say anything, and then, or, you know, we want your stories, but if you speak out against something or if you disagree with something, you're kind of glanced over.
And I would guess that has roots in the long cultural and social history of people of color and African Americans in particular in America,
mm-hmm.
without question.
Go ahead. Of course, you know, so we're coming into the holiday season. And that's a time of big meals, family gatherings. What are the kinds of meals that we prepare for each other at the holidays? What are the stories that they tell us?
They are one of the, it just like, that just jogs my memory of like so many Thanksgivings with my family. One of the most like vivid memories of from like elementary school is we did like a Thanksgiving, like what does your Thanksgiving table look like, and my mom's family is from St. Thomas, and we had just had some of our family from down there come up for Thanksgiving, and we had like lobster tails stuffed with like Caribbean spices and all sorts
good.
Of stuff. So good.
Really?
You have to get something to eat after this.
And there's other stuff that we make.
I brought snacks.
There's other stuff that we make, like with, you know, cornbread and gizzards and, you know, sweet potatoes with raisins, and all this stuff has, you know, roots in like the Taino people of the Caribbean, and and the French and Dutch influence in the Virgin Islands in particular. And when I said that to my class, not all that part, but like, you know, we had lobster tails and this and that, everyone was like, wow, that's
like the
so...
record skipped, right?
Yeah, they were like, that's so weird. Like, but, you know, there's all these little regional differences. Like, we're in New England. Like, there's stuff that is eaten here that isn't eaten in any other part of the country. So Thanksgiving tables are completely, like what I was saying before, they're completely, they speak to where you are and what time you're there, and you as a person and your family and culture.
So we have to ask, what are you going to be serving or eating on Thanksgiving, and also later holidays and holiday season?
So I am recently married, and my
congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
And my husband likes to make a whole duck.
A whole duck.
The holidays, huh. Yeah. He just likes duck in general, but okay. Like. He started this tradition of finding and roasting a whole duck in our oven. So
he doesn't hunt, so these aren't ducks. Okay.
No, so.
But he'll get one in the market.
Yeah, and roast it in our oven, and I'll make, like, the sides. And I try to, like, do turkey parts instead of a whole turkey because we don't need it's only two of us. We don't need, like, a whole duck and a whole turkey.
So talk to us a little bit about A Hungry Society, your podcast.
Yes, so A Hungry Society is on Heritage Radio Network, and it focuses on the diverse aspects of the food world. I started it because I noticed that food media tends to talk about the same people a lot of the times, and there's so much cool work happening in the food space in this country right now. So it's kind of like my way of documenting all of the cool things that are happening in food.
Heritage Radio Network. We were talking before the show where it is broadcast from or podcast from. Tell us about that. It's not like your basic studio.
No.
It's quite different. Tell us.
It is not your typical podcast studio. So Heritage Radio Network started in 2009 by Patrick Martin, who founded Heritage Foods. And basically they dropped two shipping containers behind Roberto's restaurant.
You mean these big containers you see on ships?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Just like very bare bones, literally two shipping containers.
Just the metal and that's it.
In the back of a pizza restaurant in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And from there, it's grown into this network with like 40 plus hosts, including myself. And the shipping containers are still pretty rustic, but there's AC now, there's heat, and there's actually like a window. So if you're dining in Roberto's, you can actually see into the studio as people record, which
that's
is
really
very cool.
Where do you find your guests?
All over. So I read a lot, and if I think someone's doing something cool, I'll reach out to them. Also social media.
Yeah. And are they principally from the New York area?
They end up being from the New York area, but I've actually started going out and doing like
you got
little
a great little microcosm of global food.
Oh
right
yeah, you don't have to go outside the city to find pretty much everything. So these are people from all cultures and groups.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I could even find some of my distant Irish relatives maybe doing like corned beef and cabbage.
Yeah, that would
which
be
which by
a
the way
show,
is a good
yeah.
dish.
Yeah. My mom used to make that.
Did she really?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
I did, yeah. She just loved corned beef and cabbage.
Yeah, it's a simple but tasty meal.
So there's a questions of race sort of weave throughout your work and the interaction between race and identity and food.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a simple takeaway from your writing on that issue in particular, what would it be?
Oh, that's tough because I think race and identity and food, I don't think it's simple. I think it is unique and complicated. People's relationships to food, period, are complicated depending on, you know, their stories. But I think the thing that runs through my work is that I believe that food and restaurants and hospitality can help create equality. I think we all love going out to eat. We all love eating. And I think it's a way of having those conversations, of pushing for everyone to be equal. And I think it's just the best medium for that.
Clearly, it can bring people together. So if If you could bring someone to a meal, someone you have never met, maybe someone whose opinions you don't agree with, either past or present, who might that be, would you think, or what would you serve, and what would you hope to accomplish over a meal? And I'm, again, I'm talking somebody that you do not
agree with.
But food, I think we've established here, is a good way of commonality, even if you come from very polar extremes, mm-hmm. politically or otherwise. Does anybody come to mind? Or?
Ooh, someone did come to mind. It was Ivanka Trump at first.
Yeah.
I feel like there's got to be someone else that also I would want to talk to.
So it would be maybe someone on the national level in terms of?
Yes, absolutely.
Because we certainly are living in divided times.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny, you know, because we talk all the time about breaking bread with somebody because there's something in that experience, that shared communal meal that is transformative, or can be transformative, but it's not always, right? Yeah. And you know, the challenges that emerge from that are pretty profound. Are you optimistic that the kind of work that you're doing can have the positive impact on the kind of dialogue that we're having around tables over meals or whatnot?
I don't know if that's my goal. I think that feels very, that would be great if that happened. But I think my work is more on a more local level. And when I say local, I don't mean like just my community. I think what I see my role as is, you know, trying to empower women that look like me. Who don't often get the mic to speak. That is my goal. I get messages from young women who want to be chefs, who want to be writers. How do I get into this? And so I try to think about them when I'm writing pieces or when I'm doing anything. And if that in turn changes the discourse, then that's great.
Korsha Wilson, your work is remarkable. Thank you so much for being with us. She's Korsha Wilson. The podcast is A Hungry Society. You should check it out. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org. We can also catch up on previous episodes. He's Wayne. I'm Jim. We hope you'll join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.